Okay, Boker Tov, everybody, and welcome back to a new year of learning. Good to see everyone. Okay, we'll jump right in to an interesting concept that we need to discuss based on our Parshat Yitro last week and Parshat Mishpatim this week. It explores a fundamental principle when we look at trying to understand and appreciate the nature of how Torah was communicated to Am Yisrael. So as we know that Am Yisrael's finest moment is described in Parshat Yitro with the revelation at Sinai and our receiving Hashem's Torah. It becomes a fundamental principle of faith, which the Mishnayot, famous Mishnayot in Masechet Avot, Pirkei Avot, begins with, where we talk about Moshe Kibel Torah mi Sinai, that Moshe Rabbeinu received Torah from Sinai. And this principle is known to us as Torah min HaShamayim, that, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Torah directly, a divine gift from Hashem to Moshe Rabbeinu. And no human being had any, in a sense, investment or had no contribution to make to the actual content of Torah itself. Of course, the contribution comes after Torah is given, when Hashem teaches Moshe Rabbeinu the method by which Torah should be communicated. But in principle, we have this fundamental idea that Moshe Kibel Torah mi Sinai. So we're going to quickly explore that concept a little bit deeper to try and define exactly what it means that Moshe received Torah at Sinai. Now, often what is understood by this, probably mistakenly, is that we think that the exact text of the Torah as we have it today, that is the exact same text that was dictated to Moshe at Har Sinai. And that idea, even though many of us know of it, but it's not accurate. In other words, of course, the content is exactly the same, and Hashem dictates to Moshe Rabbeinu what to write. But there's a bit of a process to get to the final version of what we know as the text of the Sefer Torah. And the support for this idea that there's kind of like an evolution with a small e, if you will, where the text of Torah itself mutates over time, is supported by the idea that the way that the Torah content is introduced to Moshe Rabbeinu the Torah uses three specific expressions, and they're all slightly different from each other as to how Torah concepts were introduced to Moshe Rabbeinu. So we have at least three sukkim, or expressions in Torah, as to how Hashem communicates Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu. The first one is Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe. Hashem spoke to Moshe Bahar Sinai Lemor, while he was on the mountain, in the vicinity of the mountain. That's phrase one, where Hashem speaks to Moshe, and the Torah tells you Bahar Sinai Lemor. The second expression in the Torah is Vaydaber Hashem Elav. Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu May Oel Moed Lemor, from the tent of meeting. In other words, from the Mishkan area. In the Mishkan, there was the Holy of Holies, and that area is considered the Oel Moed, where Hashem's presence rested, or the focal point of spirituality in the desert was there. And Moshe Rabbeinu would receive prophecy emanating from the Kodesh HaKodashim. And that's by Daber Hashem Elav. Hashem speaks to Moshe from this Oel Moed. And then the third expression that we find in the Psukim of Torah is that Hashem spoke to Moshe by Daber Hashem and Moshe Barvot Moav. Just when Am Yisrael were on the border of the Jordan River, about to enter into the land of Israel. And Moshe Rabbeinu bid Am Yisrael farewell, he begins his famous last speech in that location called Arvot Moav, the plains of Moav. And it's there that he takes his leave of Klal Yisrael. But before he does so, he hands over to Am Yisrael the content of Torah that eventually becomes the text that we work with. So what we are trying to describe here is that the principles of Torah, the actual details of the mitzvot, were all taught to Moshe Rabbeinu while he was on Har Sinai. These details are then repeated in the Ohel Moed, and then a third time while he's in the area of Arvot Moav. So what happens is that Moshe Rabbeinu actually receives three different, not in content different, but three different expressions of the details of the mitzvot. And at the conclusion of Moshe's leadership, the 40 years in the desert, Hashem then instructs Moshe Rabbeinu how to put the final text together. We've had three major interactions here, and these three interactions have expressed the content and the details of the mitzvot in a specific manner. And now we have to put together a kind of edited version, but not edited to edit out things, but rather a final expression of how Torah is going to be studied as the people of Israel write the Sifrei Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu actually writes them and gifts them to each tribe, gets the Sefer Torah. And from there, we move into the land of Israel. Now, in order to appreciate what's gone on here, is as follows. What we need to understand is that when Am Yisrael and Hashem enter into this covenant at Har Sinai, that experience of the revelation at Sinai, it's that experience is not responsible for the obligation of the people of Israel as a whole to abide by the Torah. In other words, let's explain it this way. Har Sinai took place, the revelation took place, and it cemented a relationship between Am Yisrael and Hashem. And at the end of the revelation, right at the end of Sefer Shmot, and Sefer Vayikra, actually, the Torah tells you that Hashem contracts this relationship, he cements it, and we are taught Eile Achukim VaMishpatim. These are all the laws and statutes, VaTorot, that Hashem gave to Moshe Rabbeinu to give to Am Yisrael, Beino Uvein B'nei Yisrael, Bahar Sinai. So at the end of Sefer Vayikra, we are taught that there's a set of details that were given to Moshe Rabbeinu on Sinai, and a kind of a brit, a relationship, a contract, a covenant was forged between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu at that point in time. Now, we're going to call that covenant Brit Sinai, the unique relationship that was cemented at Sinai. This idea of a covenant is then repeated, and a second covenant is contracted between Hashem and Am Yisrael right at the end of Moshe's reign as the leader of Am Yisrael. So right at the end of Sefer Devarim, when Moshe Rabbeinu finishes giving over his speech to Am Yisrael, right at the end of that book of Devarim, there's a set of rebuke and curses and warnings that Hashem or Moshe Rabbeinu gives Am Yisrael. And at the end of that whole set of curses or warnings, the pasuk says, "Eile divrei habrit." You know, this is these are the words of the covenant. Asher tziva Hashem et Moshe, which Hashem commanded Moshe, lichrot et bnei Yisrael be'eretz Moav. Lichrot means to cement, to create the covenant that takes place in the land of Moab, and that is a covenant milvad habrit, over and above the covenant asher karati itam b'chorev, over and above the covenant that was contracted, that was cemented with Am Yisrael and Hashem b'chorev at Har Sinai. So there's essentially a reference to a second covenant which takes place here at the final, you know, farewell between Moshe Rabbeinu and Am Yisrael. The question now is, why do you need these two different covenants? You know, what exactly is the difference between the two covenants, the one at Sinai and the one here at on the threshold of Am Yisrael entering into the land of Israel? So this discussion or this question is meant to help us understand what was stated, what I mentioned here in the beginning, and that is that the actual obligation that all of us have to observe all of the mitzvot that are listed in the Torah is not actually because of the experience of the revelation at Sinai. In other words, every single Jewish person is obligated in mitzvot. The question is, when did the obligation start? And how was it cemented that every Jew subsequent that's born or converts into Judaism has an obligation going forward to the end of time? Which covenant obligated us in the performance or adherence to all of the mitzvot? So we work with the principle that all of our souls, every Jewish soul, was present at Har Sinai. And therefore, we have many ideas, fundamental principles, that are taken out of that idea that every Jewish neshama heard Hashem's revelation at Sinai. And there was an impact of that revelation on every neshama that was there. And so when you hear, or we study in the Gemara, we hear in the world of Halakha and Midrash, that there are certain character traits that are embedded in the DNA of Am Yisrael. We are taught that we have a natural proclivity to be Rachmanim, you know, who are merciful, Bayashanim, who are bashful, Gomlei Chasadim. You know, we have kindness rooted into our core. That is the impact of what took place at Sinai. And anybody who lacks these character traits, one has to look and investigate if they really are Jewish at heart. Now, that is one expression of how Mamad Har Sinai, the revelation at Sinai, impacted each individual neshama. But really what was happening at Sinai was the impact was felt by the spiritual essence of every single neshama. But the bodies of the actual people, in other words, the Brit Sinai is not legally binding, you know, on every one of the Jewish people, because the neshamas had that experience. A legally binding covenant, you know, needs to be contracted in a way that the human being, a set of people, accepted upon themselves, you know, going forward. And so Rashi tells us that, based on a Gemara in Masechet Shvuot, that the Gemara tells us that the original covenant at Sinai was really only contracted with the people that were alive at the time and not with all future generations. And therefore, we today are not obligated to observe the mitzvot because of the experience at Sinai. We are obligated to observe the mitzvot because of the second covenant that took place in Arvot Moav. And it's that unique covenant that was contracted and cemented with Moshe Rabbeinu as the leader of Klal Yisrael and the recipient of Torah and the teacher of Torah. And the covenant contracted at Arvot Moav, it's that covenant which actually has the power and was set up in such a way to obligate every single Jew going forward from that time. And this is what the Pasuk means at the beginning of Parshat Nitzavim, which is right at the end there of Sefer Devarim. There, Moshe Rabbeinu tells Am Yisrael that this covenant that we are going to make now, the second covenant, is unique because the words in the Torah are, Anochi koreitet abrit hazot. It's not just with you people here now that are physically present that I make this covenant. The nature of this covenant is, you know, even for these people, we have to make a covenant that exists for people asher einenu po imanu hayom, that they're not yet. We have to cement a covenant, we have to write up a covenant, we have to commit to a situation that is different from what happened at Mamre Har Sinai. Mamre Har Sinai had a unique impact upon the neshamas of all Jews, but the actual legal obligation to the mitzvot really is cemented over here in the second covenant that took place at the location of Arvot Moav. So it's interesting that the theory that we're working with here is not so well known in this level of detail, where you can, you know, people, you might get the feeling that we're trying to undermine or say something that's not Torahdic when we say that the nature of the covenant at Sinai didn't obligate all Jews for all times. But what we're saying is that it had impact, a major impact, on cementing the relationship between Am Yisrael and Hashem. But in order to have something legally binding, the contract has to be contracted in a certain way that satisfies all legal obligations. So we had to accept a commitment that committed everybody going forward. So La Havdil, you know, it's an interesting discussion as to how contracts or treaties that are made politically by governments, you know, how they bind all future generations who may not have necessarily signed on to those original principles. So if you ask yourself, okay, you've got a constitution that the government, let's say the American Constitution takes on certain principles. Those principles are written into a constitution. And we understand that those principles are binding on everyone, you know, who is an American citizen, you know, going forward, you know, for all time. So this would be the interesting, you know, question is, can can the freedom of choice be used, you know, to annul the Constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech? You know, can you do that? Can you vote the Constitution out? So these are interesting legal questions, and it all goes down to how you understand the covenant that was made. I mean, if the government of America makes a principle, you know, it binds itself to a principle, makes a treaty, an agreement with another country, and then a new government comes in. What level of obligation does the new government had to uphold a treaty that the old government, you know, had? What happens if the new government disagrees and thinks the treaty was wrong? You know, so you enter into an agreement, whether it's with Iran or UNRWA, you know, or Israel, and then all of a sudden the new government comes in and starts to play with that. You have to work out legally what, you know, where the obligations lie. And if you don't have a commitment, then each government that go, each the two parties that come together, you know, have to say, well, what stability exists in the agreement if it can be undone every 4 years? But at the same time, if the thing was wrong and you want to rectify something that now the people think was wrong, you have to have a way to amend it. So these are all the legal arguments behind, you know, agreements, contacts, covenants, you know, that are made by governing bodies. So Mamad Har Sinai, the actual revelation at Sinai, the impact on all neshamas was felt. But the legally binding nature of mitzvot can only be binding on a person. And therefore, there had to be another covenant, a second covenant, you know, that was structured in such a way that all future generations would be bound, you know, to it. And this is exactly what happened at Arvot Moav. So there was Sinai, you know, and then there was a second covenant called, you know, Brit Moav. There's Brit Sinai and Brit Moav. Now, we obviously have to ask ourselves, why was it done like that? You know, why was the covenant at Sinai limited in a certain, what was the objective of the revelation at Sinai that we just read about in Shul? You know, there was this declaration of the Aseret HaDibrot, and that declaration of the 10 utterances, or what we call the 10 commandments. You know, we have to understand what exactly the purpose, you know, of it all was. So here you actually have fundamental debates that take place between you know, the medieval thinkers and philosophers in their commentaries on Torah. Now, part of the interesting discussion revolves around understanding the description of when events took place. And when you read the story of the revelation at Sinai, and you read it in Parshat Yitro, and then you read this week's set of Parshat Mishpatim, which kind of has part B in the description of what happened at Sinai. It sort of like gives you all the legalities, and then at the end of the Sedra, it adds details to the actual experience at Sinai. So you've got to see the psukim in Parshat Yitro and the end of Parshat Mishpatim. You've got to work out how they are related. In other words, they talk about the same event. Question is, you know, what is the chronological placement of Parshat Yitro and Parshat Mishpatim? Is it chronological or is it not? And this is a famous machloket, argument between the various thinkers as to the nature of these two sets of psukim, Yitro and Mishpatim. So Ramban, the Moshe ben Nachman, Nachmanides, he is dedicated to the principle that Parshat Yitro and Parshat Mishpatim are accurately chronologically placed. In other words, Yitro comes first, and then comes Mishpatim. And what that means for us is that the revelation at Sinai, the declaration of the Aseret HaDibrot in Parashat Yitro, you know, is a unique step in the overall conversion of the Jewish people. So in other words, in order to move from being, let's call ourselves Israelites, who were redeemed from Egypt, who had a common tradition and culture, a common language, common sets of rules or laws, a few of them that held us together. So we needed to become halachically Jewish. We needed to have an elevated neshoma, or a crystallizing of the Jewish neshoma, at a certain point in time. And that process is called conversion. That's exactly what conversion really means. And so what we understand here is that there was a process of conversion that Am Yisrael had to go through for every single person. So all of our ancestors are considered, you know, converts in that regard. And the process of conversion is something that is cemented by various principles and accepted by what we know as a four-stage process. If you're a guy, you need a Brit Milah. You know, for girls, it's accepting the yoke of mitzvot, it's going to the mikvah, and it's a sacrifice, a korban, that has to be offered on behalf of all of us, which was done at Sinai. And so in Parashat Mishpatim, that sacrifice is described. So what the Ramban sees as a big picture, the so-called circumcision in Egypt before we left, the idea of having a portable mikveh, you know, Be'er Miriam's source of water with us throughout the desert experience, that concept miraculously allowed us to go to a mikveh in the desert. It was kind of like this unique, miraculous phenomenon of having a permanent water source, not just for drinking, but for mikveh purposes as well, with us in the desert. That was in the merit of Miriam. So Am Yisrael, you know, went through the experience. The guys went through the Brit Milah experience. They then, guys and girls, had a mikveh experience. And they then had to accept the yoke of mitzvot upon themselves, which was the Sinai experience. And they had to have the actual korban sacrifice, which is described as at the end of Parashat Mishpatim. So these four stages really create the full conversion of Am Yisrael from Israelite to halachic Jew through the experience of Sinai. That halachic Jew status is cemented at Sinai. You know, now the Ramban doesn't say that we weren't Jewish before. You know, others do. We weren't halachically Jewish until Sinai, but he's trying to demonstrate that however you want to understand the status of the Jew, the Israelite before Sinai, at Sinai, the unique nature of conversion was complete. So there was a process of conversion, really, and the Sinai experience is the source of what we do today. All the laws of conversion are extracted from the experience of Am Yisrael, you know, at Ma'amar HaSinai. And so just as Am Yisrael undertook, you know, the the process of circumcision, mila and tevila in a mikveh, and the offering of a korban, you know, all leading up to the acceptance of Torah. So all future converts receive a brit mila for males and go to a mikveh and bring a korban. Now, you know, the fourth part of the conversion process is what we call the actual acceptance of mitzvot. So when we say Naaseh v'nishma, you know, when we said that, that was the acceptance of that's Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot. Without that final Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot, without that, the Geirus is invalid. And so really, Naaseh v'nishma, even though it's, let's call it popularly related in our minds to the experience of Sinai as it's expressed in Parashat Yitro, the truth is the phrase Naaseh v'nishma is actually at the end of Parashat Mishpatim, and it's only when Naaseh v'nishma is stated by everybody that is the description of all of Am Yisrael accepting mitzvot upon them, and at the end of Parashat Mishpatim you get the Naaseh v'nishma and the korban, which complete the actual conversion process. So this is what we do today. If somebody wants to convert to Yiddishkeit, so we spend, you know, months, years teaching the actual details of the mitzvot, and then at a certain point in time, the actual convert has to make an oath of sorts. You accept upon yourself the obligation of all the mitzvot. That's Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot. So the Ramban has described Yitro and Mishpatim as, you know, the conversion process of all of Am Yisrael who were there present at the time. That's how he sees the whole exercise of the revelation at Sinai. Rashi learns it differently. Rashi thinks that the section that deals with the revelation of at Sinai in Parshat Yitro and that in Parshat Mishpatim are not in chronological order. You know, first the Jewish people undergo the conversion process, which is described in Parshat Mishpatim. They do that first, which includes Naaseh v'nishma, you know, and the actual sacrifice. And then only after the conversion process has finished, completed, then the event described in Parshat Yitro of Hashem revealing himself to Am Yisrael, only then did that take place. The revelation at Sinai, the Ten Commandments, took place after the actual national conversion of all of Am Yisrael. That's Rashi's opinion. It's a real interesting debate here as to how to interpret what goes on. You know, what happened when exactly. So this is really an interesting way of understanding it. Rav Soloveitchik expressed it like this. He said, you know, the argument between Rashi and the Ramban revolves around the question as to whether the event of Ma'amad Har Sinai, the revelation at Sinai, was presented before halachic non-Jews or halachic Jews. What was the status of Am Yisrael, you know, at Sinai? You know, did they have a full Jewish, holy Jewish neshama, or did that take place after the Ma'amad Har Sinai? So this is the argument that that Rashi and the Ramban, you know, actually have, that it's a real interesting question as to how it evolved as far as we are concerned. Anyhow, this is part and parcel of the understanding that Rashi wants to give us, and that is that, not like the Ramban, that it was part of the conversion process. The conversion was finished before the Aseo Tati brot took place. So from Rashi's point of view, what was the major purpose of the declaration or the revelation of Torah to the people of Israel through the Ten Commandments? So Rashi learns, similar to how Rav Sadia Gaon, who predated Rashi, they all looked to the Aseret HaDibrot as a kind of summary, where the Ten Commandments, embedded in the Ten Commandments, you'll find hints to all of the thought that are there. And more than that, the experience of Mamar HaSinai was necessary because it taught us how to teach future generations of Jews to be good Jews. In other words, it's not so much the content of the Aseret HaDibrot that's fundamental here. In other words, the content is going to be an ongoing process of Torah transmission. But how do you transmit Torah? How do you teach it? How do you? That is really the goal of the revelation at Sinai. In other words, Torah should be taught from a Rebbe to a Talmud, the same way which Hashem taught Torah to the Jewish people. The whole model, the paradigm of transmitting Torah, is really the goal of the experience at Sinai. And there are so many details or laws that are extracted from the experience, which directly relate to how we are supposed to talk to our children about Torah. So when Moshe Rabbeinu summarizes the experience at Sinai, one of the expressions in the pasuk that he uses is that v'hodatam levanecha v'livnei vanecha, you have to make known v'hodatam, you have to make known to your children and grandchildren, Yom Asher Amarat Lifnei Hashem Elokecha B'Chorev, the day upon which you stood, in front of Hashem at Sinai. So there's an actual mitzvah. The Ramban holds this mitzvah to be a daily mitzvah, that there's a mitzvah to remember. One should recite a little line or expression. Every day one should say, one of the major six remembrances that the Ramban lists is to remember the experience at Sinai. So that's this. You'll find it at the back of the siddur, where you finish your daily shachrit, and after you finish the daily shachrit and you've finished the shir shel yom, etc., you just flip over, and you'll find in the art scroll that in most siddurim they'll list the six remembrances that Ramban thinks are a daily obligation on all of us to remember. So, we make a fuss maybe once a year of doing it, like with Amalek, etc. But the Ramban thinks the word Zachor implies a daily commitment. And so many of us have the minhag to just recite those six remembrances. So there's Egypt, there's the experience at Sinai, there's the concept of the war against the eternal war against Amalek. There's the experience of Miriam's Loshon Hora. There's the Jewish people's infidelity with a golden calf that's expressed there as well. And then there's Shabbos. Those are the six Zachors. Every one of those ideas are introduced with the word Zachor, or don't forget. In this case, V'hodatam levanecha, you shall make known to your children and grandchildren, the day upon which the Sinai experience took place, or what happened over there. So this is exactly what the Gemara Masechet Brachot derives out of this this pasuk. It's not just to remember what took place there, but what the Gemara interprets is that, this is how you have to teach or learn Torah with our children, in the exact same fashion that we received Torah at Sinai, just as Torah was received, with Ema, Yira, Retet, and Zaya. These are four expressions of dread and awe, trembling and fear. These elements have to be present whenever Torah is taught. There's a kind of there's a reverence, a level of respect. There's a the nature of how the transmission must take place. This is a concept which we refer to as reenacting Ma'amar Har Sinai every time we teach and learn Torah. And so this is kind of the Gemara's interpretation, but it also gives us an opportunity to appreciate that, at least according to Rav Soloveitchik's understanding of Rashi, that this is the major impact on on Am Yisrael by experiencing the Ma'amar Har Sinai. So the experience was not like the Ramban thinks it's like the conversion. It's part of the conversion process. Rashi thinks the conversion process needed to be complete before we had the so-called experience. However you want to interpret, it's interesting to see that the idea behind it is interesting as to how the obligation starts to emerge on all of us as future Jewish people. So again, Rashi, looking at all the various different Gemaras, will take details out of the whole experience as how to transmit Torah. So just to give you one more example, just like you had Hashem speaking to Moshe Rabbeinu and then Moshe Rabbeinu teaching it to Klal Yisrael, so there needs to be a teacher in the middle of the experience. In the days of old, in the times of the Gemara, they used to call the intermediary teacher. There would be the great Rosh Hashiva who gives the shiur, let's call it very, very tersely or succinctly. And then you needed somebody who was gifted to be able to unpack it so that everybody understood it. Sometimes the great scholar would not have the gift of the gab. So he would say something and it needed to be unpacked. And you had a person by the name of, the title given to him was a Maturgaman. He was the actual teacher as opposed to the lecturer, if you will. So to make sure that the information was given, so Moshe Rabbeinu was that personality. Moshe Rabbeinu hears the Torah from Hashem and then he relays it to the Jewish people. And this Maturgaman was kind of like a reenactment of what happened at Sinai. On Shabbos, on Yom Tov, during the week when we have the mitzvah of reading Torah from the actual scroll. So there what you have is a similar kind of scenario. You have two people standing, flanking the person who's reading the Torah on behalf of the person who got the Aliyah. This is kind of like another, it's a kind of play on what happened at Sinai, as well. So another sort of detail that's part of the actual transmission of Torah is to differentiate between how we teach Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, and Torah Shebaal Peh. This is kind of like based on what happened at Sinai. There was an element of Torah Shebichtav and the Torah Shebaal Peh, which came to explain and clarify all the details, of what took place over there. And so all these details that the Gemara uses as laws of transmission of Torah is extracted from the Ma'amar Har Sinai experience. And that's the purpose of the revelation at Sinai, how to transmit Torah. And the impact, of course, is felt deeply in the neshamas of all those that are there. It's kind of like opening up, embedding a DNA, a spiritual DNA, in the actual neshamas of all Jews. But the legally binding nature of that covenant at Sinai was for those people that were physically there. And the impact was for all future people who would inherit that DNA. And from Rashi's point of view, it's to give us the experience of how to teach and transmit Torah to all future generations. That was the Brit Sinai. Brit Moav is to obligate Am Yisrael contractually that all of us, that all of those, all of our Bobas and Zaydas who were standing there at Brit Moav, they committed to Torah for all future generations. They now understood what they were doing, and they committed all future generations of Jews, to the actual principles of Torah. You know, so that's what the Pasuk means there at the end of, at the beginning of Parshat, Nitzavim, that, lo itchem levadchem, it's not just to you alone, that you are standing over here. Lo itchem levadchem, anuchi koreitet abrit hazot. Is this covenant going to be contracted to? But it's not just et asher yeshno po imanu omeid hayom, those who are standing here, but it's also et asher einenu po imanu hayom, those that aren't with us today. And it's that Brit Moav that it creates an elevated level of responsibility. And that's really where the obligation for all of mitzvot took place. And so this is why there are these different expressions that you have within Torah, where you have Hashem, teaching Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu Bahar Sinai, and then Oel Moed, and then, Arvot Moav. That there were three different ways that Hashem expressed the principles of Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, at least three different ways. And for whatever reason, they had to be expressed in a certain manner. And the theory that we'll be working with here is that eventually, at the end of the 40 years in the desert, Hashem takes Moshe Rabbeinu aside and he says, right, this is how the text of Torah is going to look for all future generations. The first expression of Torah might have been expressed in a certain way and needed to be changed because of the way that Hashem wanted to set up his relationship with Am Yisrael by embedding certain levels of dimensions within the Torah text, within the structure of the psukim, within the letters of the actual text. Historically, Am Yisrael have moved on from when they first had the experience at Sinai. We need to capture the history of Klal Yisrael's evolution from Avraham Avinu all the way through to today. We need to capture, the universe being created and the emergence of the various cultures and their impact on society. The wars and the struggles, the personalities, all of that has to be now captured in a text. That is the miracle, so to speak, of the Torah text, that and it all needed to be gifted to Moshe Rabbeinu to give to Am Yisrael. So when you're dealing with all of this and you're trying to take an expression of godliness, which is above space and time, and you're trying to capture something which is completely spiritual, and you're trying to capture it in a physical medium, it's almost impossible to understand philosophically how to do it. How do you capture something spiritual in something physical? Our peak Kabbalah, this is exactly the miracle that takes place, in the giving of Torah to Am Yisrael. So when we discussed the Kabbalistic principles that were developed and by the various great thinkers over the last year that we discussed it, some of it, this is one of the major issues too, when you have this idea that Hashem as a spiritual entity had to make space, he had to constrict himself, what we call the Soda Tzimtzum, the idea of contraction, because there needed to be a space in which to create a physical world. That same principle that took place at the beginning of creation, where Hashem has to create a scenario by which physicality can embody spirituality, that miracle is kind of the same thing that happened at Sinai here, or through the giving of the Torah, that you had to, Hashem had to engineer a physical medium to capture his whole essence, at least a representation of Hashem's essence in the words of Torah. That is an unbelievable miracle. And really, that's really the evolution of Klal Yisrael and the transmission of Torah that took place. So this is an understanding of what we just read in Parashat Yitro. Now moving through to Parashat Mishpatim, this is what is a deeper understanding of what take place through these different covenants. Okay, I will leave it there. Nice to see everybody. Wish you all well. Shavua Tov. And look forward to seeing you either at other Shiurim or in Shul on Shabbos. Okay, have a good week.
Thanks, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
All the best.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.